to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Very fitting to have Bruce Coburn there in the background. Gotta love his playing. And as Don Cherry would say, a good Canadian kid. The Honorable David C. Onley has championed disability issues on many fronts and for many years. Having lived with polio and post-polio syndrome since the age of 3, he has broken through social barriers and become an amazing role model. In his 22-year career with City TV, he was Canada's first senior newscaster with a visible disability. A popular news anchor, host, producer, science and technology specialist, and weatherman, he showed that ability outshines disability. In view of his success in life, Mr. Onley credits his Christian faith and the ongoing support of his wife, singer and Christian recording artist Ruth Ann Onley, who I met a little while ago. Great lady she is. And their 3 sons. Not my 3 sons. That's a totally different television show. That's right. Jonathan, Robert, and Michael. Quite an interesting family and quite an interesting gentleman. And it is an honor to have your honor on the show.
Thank you very much.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you. In fact, son Robert is home from law school here, and we're just printing out documents in the background.
Wow, so that sounds exciting.
Hear printer sounds. It's family life on Saturday.
You know, I guess there's a lot of, well, maybe it's just rookie guys like me, guys that, I'm, you know, protocol. I've never been one on that, and everybody stumbles with, you know, how do we call you? What do we say? Mm-hmm. Sir, your honor, your majesty, your no, righteousness.
There's only one person reserved as your majesty in the British Commonwealth of Nations. The title is Your Honor, in the same sense that the title for a mayor is Your Worship, and a judge is Your Honor, and it is simply the title that goes with the office.
Does it make you feel awkward? It must have taken a bit to get used to, because, you know, for all intents and purposes, you're a regular guy.
Well, it's very true. The first several weeks, if not a couple months, it was a matter of there was a little bit of a reflex of looking over your shoulder when you heard the term to see who they were talking to. But it is part of the position, and one learns, I think, quickly that, in fact, the title is something that goes with the office.
Yes.
And part of the understanding and respect of the office is to realize that it's a title that has been given to you on loan, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And there will come a time at the end of the term when it gets handed on to somebody else. And so,
when does the term end?
Well, it is described constitutionally as not less than 5 years. So that would take it to September of 2012. 50% of terms of lieutenant governors in Ontario since the end of the war have been extended, and 50% of them have ended pretty much at the 5-year mark.
Right.
So that's something to be determined much further down the road.
Okay. One of the reasons I jumped on, I mean, I've been thinking about asking you for a while, but I had to ask you after I saw or listened to your comments at Sergeant Ryan Russell's funeral.
Yes.
Very, very well done.
Thank you.
Very real. And somebody else said that to me recently. You are an excellent communicator.
Well, thank you. Of course, as you mentioned off the top, you know, you and I have been in the same profession. It's it is a process of professionally communicating, and I think it is an advantage in the position, since so much of it is a matter of communicating with the public and exchanging with them. And along with it, and I don't think I could fully appreciate this coming into office, as I certainly have over the last couple of years, is that as Her Majesty's representative in the province of Ontario, there are situations such as Sergeant Russell's funeral where it is a duty calls situation, and it is your job to be the spokesperson.
Hmm.
And
but it was more than just duty. What came out of you were words that were, I think, directed towards the heart. And there's a vast difference between someone speaking out of duty and someone speaking to the heart.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And in that instance, as I was preparing the remarks, that was very much on my mind because of the nature of the officer's death. It was just so unusual, so bizarre. Mm. Had the officer been run down by a speeding car or hit on a highway or something like that, it would have been as equally tragic for him and for certainly his family and friends. But the context of this situation was just so completely bizarre that it just defied everyone's imagination. It was hard to believe that this could be happening. And then to have fallen so quickly on the heels of the Tucson tragedy, which was also just a completely bizarre circumstance, it raised the whole concept of sudden death and individuals whose job it is to protect us suddenly being struck down. And so in that particular context and that circumstance, my desire as I was preparing the remarks was, my main concern was to really speak to the family and try to speak to them on behalf of the Crown.
Well, I've grown up in the funeral business. My father has a funeral home in Richmond Hill. I've been to a lot of funerals. I used to pastor as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's too bad that it's so rare that you get someone who can say something so authentic and so refreshing, and you pulled it off. Well done.
Well, thank you.
The Honorable David C. Onley, Lieutenant Governor of Ontario. Not bad for a guy who took 7 years to get a university degree. And you didn't even get a full-time job until you were 34.
Well, very true. Very true. And I mean, I should put it in the context, at least five of those 7 years in university was because I had so much, I was having so much fun, to be perfectly honest.
Yes.
In terms of undergraduate work at the University of Toronto and political science and student politics. And
I see, that kind of fun.
It was that kind of fun, yes. It was a very good, very good time. And taking a year in terms of law school, but then realizing very, very quickly it was not my calling at all. So,
what was the most discouraging time of your life as you look back? I mean, was it while you were stuck living with your parents, writing a novel, waiting for the space shuttle to launch, while your friends had jobs and were buying cars and homes?
Well, that was a pretty significant low point. I would say that very true. I mean, I think the reality as a person with a disability, and it's I've had polio since I was three, so it's something that I, you know, literally grew up with. Encountering the reality of law school, at least part of the reason for, and a very significant part of the reason for it, to step away from it, was not only that I really felt that I wasn't particularly suited for it, although academically I was capable of doing it, but it was just too hard. It just required too much energy, and it was something that I simply did not have, because unfortunately part of the reality of polio patients, and this was not known, by the way, in the late 70s, they're just very early concepts of it, but that chronic fatigue is very much a part of the post-polio condition, so that it then became known as post-polio syndrome. I didn't understand that. And so, you know, I'd gone through the process in my life of where the doctors, and they were certainly encouraging, and as were the physiotherapists, but the perception, and I was certainly not the only one, that polio patients were simply told, well, you know, you just have to get up and try harder and get going, and you've beaten this disease, now just get out there. And it was sort of like a rah-rah-rah coach on the sidelines, not knowing that once you'd gone past a certain point, there's nothing left in the tank, and that, in fact, you're actually doing damage to yourself by just continuing to intellectually try to press on. I didn't understand that at the end of first-year law. I didn't know anything about that. And so that was a very, very low point, because it was a sobering reminder to me that, like, I just don't have the stamina to do this. Which is that experience, though, led to the opportunity of writing the book on the space program, and thankfully with my parents' support. But that's a very, very solitary profession, and I'm not a solitary person. I'm a people person, and you've nailed it on the head. There was a stretch, sort of the late 70s, where I'd been writing the book for about 2 years, and, well, you know, my friends were getting married. They were buying buying houses, and there I was still writing away.
Wow.
So that was tough.
All right. Let's go back to when you're a wee lad.
Pardon me?
Let's go back to when you're a wee lad.
Yes.
What was your best science project? And it better be it better be a good one, because the founding president of the Aerospace Heritage Foundation of Canada, you know, the guy who hosted that science show on CFRB, you better have some unbelievable science projects.
Well, I wish I could say it was the, you know, the volcano, the one that tends to, but it really wasn't. I think it was probably was something about my model train set, as a matter of fact. In terms of display and transportation, I was actually, I think, more interested in technology than I was in science per se, although I did reasonably well in some of the science subjects. But it was always the fascination of machinery, things that work, things that make us move or enable us to move. And perhaps it was in the back of my mind because, in effect, assistive devices. And so that was really my big passion growing up, planes and trucks, and they were kind of the hobbies, if you will.
Yeah. Well, yesterday was the 25th anniversary of the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster.
Yeah.
And, boy, you think back on that, and, man, 25 years, where did that go? And of course, you know, you were known as the, you know, the Space Shuttle guy in Canada.
Yes, very much so. And that was a very grim day, and I started to watch a little bit of one of the documentaries on it yesterday, and after about 30 seconds I just thought, no, I can't watch this. I don't need to go back there. The reason being was that at the time, and as a reporter for City TV, I'd been covering a number of the space flights and had made excellent contacts with Spire Aerospace, the original manufacturers of the Canadarm, now of course MD Robotics. But back then in Spire Aerospace, I'd built up a very significant range of contacts who actually, prior to even working at City TV, had been helped me as advisors in terms of my book shuttle, and it had also enabled me to get down to the Space Center in Houston to do research for the book. And without that Spire connection, I simply could not have written the book. So I'd built up a very good, better part of a decade relationship with the people there. And I'd gone in to talk to one of their public relations experts for a comment on a flight that had taken place about a year and a half earlier. And as I came into his office and we were setting up, and he was a very traditionally a cheerful fellow, but he had a very somber look on his face. And I said, Chris, what's wrong? And he said, well, I don't know if you knew this, but we nearly lost a shuttle on the last flight, on the last takeoff. And this would have been like in late 84, something in that time frame, and maybe early 85, I guess it would have been. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, we had a problem with an O-ring on one of the solid rocket boosters, and there was burn through. And if it had burned much longer, the whole thing would have blown up on takeoff.
Oh, my goodness.
And my immediate reaction was, having heard that, was, well, this is NASA. NASA is the organization that doesn't let things like this happen. So
fix it.
Thank heavens it's now, you know, they'll fix it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, it's now a year later, a year and a half later, something like that. And I just happened to be watching, about to go out the door to go down to City TV to begin my afternoon of work, and thought, you know, I haven't recorded a space shuttle launch in a long time. So I grabbed a new tape with about 2 minutes to go before liftoff, shoved it into the VCR, turned it on, and just stood there and watched it. And, of course, you know, just 90 seconds or so into the flight, the Challenger blew up. And I just recoiled, physically recoiled, and looked away, and realized, in that split second, I thought, I know why it blew up.
Yeah.
And of course, that's exactly what it was.
All right. Well, with the conversation that you had a year and a half, 2 years earlier, whenever it was, I wonder, I mean, I don't know what happened as a result of that, as far as litigation.
That's a good question, and
if they knew what they knew then with you,
I think that it was just one of those science, one of those anomalies that happened in the system, and everyone was trying to do their best and make it work, but it just wasn't meant to be.
Here's a quote: "I'm very conscious of the fact that because of Moses' progressive attitude 20 years ago, his attitude was really cutting edge back then for an organization. I was presented with a wonderful opportunity. He hired people not because they were black or because they were women, but because they had talent.
Yep.
I wasn't hired as the token disabled guy, but because I'm talented.
Mm-hmm.
And you ended up being Breakfast Television's first news anchor.
That's correct, yes. So the weather guy to start, and Breakfast Television and education reporter. And indeed, it was Moses Neimer's approach, and that was to, you know, judge people on the basis of what their abilities were, as opposed to looking at them as some minority or as a stereotypical view.
A few less gray hairs back then. I want to play this little clip.
Hi, I'm David Onley. Behind me is the new City Pulse weather system, and here's what it can do.
Our Kavoris computer has exclusive state-of-the-art satellite pictures, easy-to-understand computer graphics, and most important, it's accurate.
Check it out, only on City Pulse, every night at 6 and 10.
Yes, yes. You notice that the viewer, obviously, on radio, the viewers can't see it, but if they actually can find that online, and as I like to tell people, those cameras from some 24, 25 years ago, the old, old technology, they make you look thinner and they make your hair look darker.
Isn't that amazing?
So, but,
well, of course, the other voice on there, Mark,
yes,
Mark Daly.
Rest his soul.
We all lost the voice of Toronto last year.
Yeah.
Tough loss for your family, your City TV family.
Yeah,
you know?
A very, very significant loss. And I think it operated on Mark's loss operated on many, many levels. First of all, not only that he had fought prostate cancer and so bravely, quite frankly, 6 years ago and had beaten it, but that he was very, very public about it, and not only was the treatment and the surgery was a part of different news stories that he did, but it was advocating on behalf of men being aware of prostate health and going for regular checkups. And as I've said on different occasions, I know that, you know, I had put off getting a check for which I was overdue, and Mark was one of the one, you know, came up, have you had your test yet? Have you gone to be checked?
No, it'd be more like, have you had your check yet?
Yes, yes, you got that right. So, but then to have come down with this, you know, second bout of cancer, and we all just honestly believed he was going to beat it. And I talked with him on the phone 2 days after he had had his surgery, late last fall, and his voice was just as strong and vibrant and powerful as it was and had been before. And so you want to just have the perception of, well, Mark will do it again, and on we'll go. And then it unfortunately was not to be. And when he passed, I think the thing that struck people, basically as I think of the different people that I interacted with, he did so many generous things for people over the years, but he never talked about it. And it wasn't until he had passed away that as I was reading online and listening to the news reports, you'd hear people telling these individual stories about some generous thing that he had done, you know, just essentially because that's the kind of guy he was, but he never talked about it. So if he had done it for you, well, you just kind of thought he's just doing it for me, but in fact, he was doing it for everybody.
Good.
So, yeah.
We need more of those kinds
Absolutely.
Of guys, that's for sure. Your Honor, can you tell us maybe a little bit behind the scenes, a little something that went down, some squirrely happenings behind the scenes at City TV? Any good anecdotes you can share?
Oh.
That you can share live.
Yeah, I can.
Here on air.
It was how I made the outtake tapes, and this ended up being, it was on various programs and definitely was recycled through for many, many years, and it was back in the days of Breakfast Television, and that is we had this little segment of the news where we would come back from a commercial break, and then and I would tell just a very brief little news story. It was just these series of updates. And I got kind of boring, so I talked to the producer, and I said, listen, if I can find just a flat-out funny story, can I slip this in as well, just to have kind of your morning chuckle? And it was and still is a very lighthearted program in addition to the news content. So he said, sure, go right ahead and do it. So I picked up this wire service, and as soon as I started to read the article, I started to laugh so hard I couldn't stop myself. And the different news writers who were sitting around me, because that's where I would do the news flash from, sitting right at the news desk, said, what's so funny? And I said, this story. And he said, well, tell us about it. So I started to read it aloud for a first time. And I could barely get through it. I was laughing so hard. And then they're all laughing so hard. And they said, oh, you got to read that one. I said, I won't be able to read it. I just can't read it. This is so funny that I'm just simply going to, I won't make it through. And they said, no, just keep reading it out loud, and we'll all get it out of our system. And we promise not to laugh in the background, because you know what it is. If one person starts, then you're gone.
Yeah.
So I just thought, okay, I got to do this. So I read it out loud, probably read it out loud about four times. And then when it came time for the countdown to get to the actual news flash itself, I realized as I looked at the camera that the cameraman was not there. He was late. He had been doing something, and he dashed into the newsroom, and he has not heard
it. Oh, he hasn't heard it. Oh, no.
So the fellow's name was Tim Dick, and unfortunately he passed away far, far too young an age, just a very unusual condition that he had. But he was a very funny fellow, and he had a great, deep laugh. He was kind of the laughter of, like, it was Ed McMahon, if you will, you know. So I started to tell this story, and the story is very simply that in Zurich, Switzerland, paramedics had to run across the street from their facility to the local supermarket because a woman had passed out, and she was found unresponsive and not breathing in the frozen food section. And what they did to treat her was they tried to get her going, and she wasn't breathing. So they loosened her blouse and wanted to do chest compression, but found they were going to have to undo her bra, at which point two frozen Cornish hens fell out. And upon them hitting the floor, she gasped and started breathing again. So your reaction is exactly what the cameraman's reaction was. And as soon as he started to laugh, then all the news writers started to laugh. And I somehow choked out the story, and all I had to be able to say was, you know, we'll be right back after this message.
Yeah.
But I couldn't even get that out. So I just waved bye-bye at the camera and turned the chair around.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was and that was live.
Yeah.
There was nothing you could do.
That's indicative of the way Tim Conway used to break up Harvey Korman. You
yes.
Know.
Well, it was very, not far off.
Oh, my goodness.
That kind of just, you couldn't, we thought it had all been under control. And and the thing was, as I was reading it, Tim was a very tall fellow, and as I was reading it, his head was blocked by the tally light on the top, but his shoulders just came above the teleprompter.
So you could see his shoulders.
And I could see his shoulders going up and down. And then I could see his hand trying to stifle his face.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Great stuff. The Honorable David C. Onley on the phone with us right now. Why? Why go from media guy to lieutenant governor, the Queen's representative of Ontario?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, first of all, I was giving a lecture yesterday to a group of public administration students from Queen's University, and one of them asked kind of a similar question. I said, well, no one ever wakes up some morning and says, you know, honey, I've got this great idea. I think I'd like to be lieutenant governor. It just doesn't work that way.
Right, right.
I had been at the point of being at City TV. I'd been there for 22 years, and in the preceding year, I had been looking to have some sort of a change in my career. I didn't know what I wanted it to be, but I felt that I had just pretty much done everything that I could do at City and CP24. The purchase by Rogers and CTV of CP24 and City TV, and the split of the one station into what was going to be two stations and two different locations and two new owners, that process was going forward, and it was really marking the end of an era, and so it seemed like a logical time. But there, although I had covered many, many events over the years where lieutenant governors had been in attendance and had interviewed various ones, I never had any particular notion about it until a colleague came up to me one day and said that she and her father had been thinking over the weekend, this would have been the Victoria Day weekend in 2006, of a proposal, and they wanted me to think about it, and that was to be what I let my name stand to be the next Lieutenant Governor of Ontario. They thought it would be a good idea, and I must tell you, my first reaction was, well, you know, it'd also be a good idea to be an astronaut someday, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Right.
But it was such an astounding suggestion. I came home and talked to my wife, Ruth Ann, about it, and I said, you know, here's something that you just have to think about for a moment or two, but here's the proposal. And her immediate reaction, without a moment's hesitation, was, well, I think that's great. I think you should do it. And that was very huge in my thinking at that point, because if she had said immediately and said, no, I don't think you should do that, well, I think I just would have skipped on right at that point and just moved on to the next topic on the agenda, if you will. But it did get me thinking about it, and I then asked a number of very, very close friends and advisors that I'd met, and some in politics, some in the arts, and some in business, and asked them what they thought about it. And they said they thought it was a very good idea and that I should let my name stand. And more than that, that they would actually help in whatever way they could.
Okay. Your Honor, did anyone ever have the testicular fortitude to say to your face that one of the main reasons you were chosen for this position in one of the most politically correct countries in the world, certainly the most politically correct province, mm-hmm. is because you're a visible minority, much like your predecessor, James Bartleman?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I absolutely preempted the law, that thinking, if you will, in the sense that if your name is put forward, at a certain point you have to let, because it is a decision made entirely by the Prime Minister, you have to let the Prime Minister's office know whether or not you are going to allow your name to stand, because they're not going to examine and ask you unless you actually do want to let your name stand. And in my letter to him, which frankly I've never really discussed at great length with anybody, but the part that I can share is that I said to the Prime Minister, in essence, I thought I had the technical requirements to become Lieutenant Governor, and I thought it was time, given the nature of our province, that there was somebody who had a physical disability to be the Lieutenant Governor if they were otherwise qualified. And here were the reasons, and here were the things I would like to do about it within the apolitical context of the Office of Lieutenant Governor. And so I sent the letter off in September of 2006, and of course the decision wasn't made until July of 2007, and it was, and you had to say absolutely nothing to anybody about it, because the one way you can guarantee that you will not be selected is to let it leak out.
Right,
so,
right.
So whenever you hear any discussion, like either Governor General or Lieutenant Governor, and you hear a name that's mentioned, you can be absolutely certain it's not that person. Guaranteed.
Guaranteed.
As the case with David Johnson pretty much showed in the last go-round for Governor General. And he is a fantastic man, by the way. Hmm. He truly is. Ruth and I would often talk about it in the intervening months, and one of our thoughts simply was, well, essentially, if the Prime Minister feels that it is time, and if he feels that I have the qualifications for it, then I'm in. Hmm. If he doesn't see it as something that's important, it doesn't matter what the qualifications are.
Exactly.
I'm not going to be in.
Yeah.
So.
At the time, I remember saying to my mother, I don't know if I should take this job at City TV. I don't know if they're hiring me because I'm disabled. My mother said, you've been turned down enough times because of your disability, so take it. I thought to myself, damn it, she's right.
Yep.
And that's how my career at City TV began.
Yeah, that quote is mostly correct. I will say I didn't say, damn it, she's right.
Oh, great. I didn't have to say it either?
No, you didn't have to say it, but it's one of those things that it's slipped into there. But I certainly don't recall saying it. It's just some people have difficulty with certain words. I don't. It's not part of my vernacular. But be it as it may, it was definitely a sobering moment from my mother when I did get the opportunity to work at City TV, because the situation with Moses Neimer was in some ways analogous to the position of Lieutenant Governor, and that is that I hadn't applied for it.
Right.
It was somebody else who thought it would be a good idea. In this case, the person was Moses Neimer, who had seen me as an MC at a function at the Science Center with two astronauts and became aware of my knowledge base related to the shuttle and the space program, and he just filed away mentally that the next time there was an opening, he was going to ask me, and that opening happened to be weatherman. And but at that time, I was 34. I was working at a radio station. Ruth and I just had, you know, a newborn baby, and I was just sort of getting myself settled into this position with the CKL Radio News Network, no longer with us, of course.
Right.
And I just thought, wow, if I'm going to be on TV, everybody's going to see me as disabled on TV, and I'm not sure I'm ready for that, and I'm not sure whether I'm actually being picked, not because he thinks I have the talent, but because he wants another minority on the screen. And that's when this was literally the day of the meeting that I had with Moses, where he called me in, and I thought he was calling me in for something completely different, absolutely completely different, and offered me the position. And then I tried to get a hold of Ruth and couldn't get a hold of her, so called my mother, and then, you know, looking for that sort of sympathetic response. And Mom read the riot act to me. Well, you take it, you know.
Well,
but I believe she was right.
Yeah.
And I believe there were, and I believe, unfortunately, that still prevails today, because notwithstanding the fact, and this is a large part of what I do talk about as Lieutenant Governor, when I'm invited to attend different functions, and whether it's business meetings or churches or wherever, is that while we've made enormous progress in terms of making our society physically accessible, the changes have been profound over 25 years, ramps, automatic doors, wheelchair parking spots, just the whole range of services and gadgets and gizmos that are out there, that's happened, but the percentage of unemployment, the unemployment rate for people with disabilities has remained unbelievably high, at virtually the 50% mark, and it hasn't changed. It hasn't really budged more than a percentage point or two over all these years. And the reason, ultimately, is that there are too many employers, people in the position of making decisions about who gets hired, who make value judgments about the potential worth of an individual based on the first impression, based on that first look. And we know this from different surveys and studies that have been done. So, you know, it's something that I encountered early on in my career, because there I was at 34, really getting my first full-time job, because I'd been turned down for so many prior to that. And so hence my mother's response.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, have you been able to get them to put in a ramp access to the throne in the legislature, Queen's Park? I mean, you had to use braces and canes to get up. They didn't know the guy who was using it that day was disabled?
Well, no. It's actually those stairs were redesigned, and the railing was redesigned to get up to give the speech from the throne, and actually specifically first for my installation address. But you know, through the Speaker of the House and the group that's called Precinct Properties, which is the name of the Speaker's group within the Legislative Assembly, Queen's Park has been very, very much improved over the last 3 years, making more ramped access that is meets modern code and modern standards. And an elevator has been installed in the west entrance of the building so that people visiting the Lieutenant Governor's office who have mobility issues can have the same entrance that able-bodied people do up a long flight of stairs, and not have to literally go through the cafeteria in order to get back by the basement, by the shipping and receiving, to get to the office of Lieutenant Governor.
You know, okay, I'm sure you've had people say this to you before. This is the average Joe's response, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I pull up to Home Depot and it's minus 29 out,
yeah,
and there's 372 handicap parking spots that are empty,
mm-hmm,
and I got to park out in the back 40, I'm saying to myself, we've gone a little far here.
It's an interesting observation, and I think a large part of the problem is that in the store's attempt to, you know, to address a problem, I think in some instances it's just has gone too far. It doesn't happen a lot, but it does, and I can understand people's frustrations. On the other hand,
we've got handicapped parking, mm-hmm, spots, we've got pregnant mothers, expectant,
yes,
mothers, senior,
yes,
citizens. I mean, there's, like, seriously, you have to, yes, take a shuttle to get to the store these days.
And those, by the way, the only ones that can be enforced legally are actually the wheelchair parking spots. The other ones are
the other ones you don't park there because you need to be terrified of that pregnant woman getting out of the car and beating you to a pulp.
With the brawling.
Look, I think it's an issue that you're winning.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder how the politically correct insanity of this country has taken things too far. You know, where are we as far as being too politically correct, in your estimation?
Well, in terms of what I zero in on is the whole aspect of people with disabilities. And what I try to get people, what I talk about is seeing people for who they really are and making the judgment on that basis. And the way I do it is I talk about the employment opportunities is that unfortunately we do form value judgments about people. It's a human tendency. But so put yourself in the position of the employer who, you know, is now interviewing people in the afternoon, and yet there's a new restriction on them, and that is this, that you can't ask a person's name, and you cannot see them from the waist up. You can only see them from the waist down. And so if you reject the guy with the one artificial leg only because he has an artificial leg, then you've missed hiring Terry Fox. And if you reject the guy in the wheelchair only because he's in a wheelchair, then you've missed hiring Rick Hansen.
Yeah, or if you base it on the fact they've got really nice shoes, nice pair of pants, mm-hmm. then you've missed out on the fact that you've just hired Don Cherry.
Yes. And you can extend it. You know, you really can. I mean, you can, and the reality is that people do make that judgment. And so you got to get to that point of saying, well, wait a minute, we're not going to do that. I am going to try to look beyond because maybe I do want to have Rick Hansen work for me or Chantal Petitclerc or Stephen Hawking, for instance, by way of another example, somebody who can't even talk himself but relies on a computer.
He would be good at the drive-through window at McDonald's, I think.
There's a good
very similar voice.
That.
Oh, is there?
Yeah. But so, you know, I think it's a matter of appealing to the best instincts of people as opposed to trying to prescribe rules and regulations. And I think, by and large, people do and will respond to it. You know, I had a wonderful conversation towards the end of her term of office with Michael Jean for about half an hour at Rideau Hall. And it really was a reflective time for her as she was looking back and really essentially getting ready to turn the authority of the office of Governor General over to a new person, and nobody knew who that was at that point. And she was saying that one of the things that she had found that she had enjoyed the most, and it certainly is something that I've experienced, is that the Canadian people, and as in my experience here just in Ontario, but Canadian people do want to hear about not in terms of just positive things, but they want to hear about apolitical things. They want to hear about what it is that they can do to help in our society. They don't want to always be hearing the politicians who are presenting their views and attacking the other guy's views, and they don't want to hear the hectoring from special interest groups and people in the media necessarily. But what they do want to hear is, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What can I do to help change it? And the information is presented in an apolitical way. It's not partisan. And it's these higher themes, if you will. And I know I've certainly experienced that, and that's the message, that's the approach that I try to take. And I found it interesting that after 5 years of being the Governor General of Canada, with an amazing range of experiences, that was the huge takeaway that she had as the experience.
Hmm. You know, I wonder if, Your Honor, if you ever get tired of the disabled community treating you like you're their deliverer, you know, because I'm sure every once in a while you just want to snap back at someone you know has been wallowing in self-pity for far too long, and you just want to tell them what Father Belanger said in that hospital to you when you were 9 years old.
Yes.
You know, you're not going to die tonight.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting because that's a great little side story with Father Belanger, and that was an enormously key moment in my life, because when you're 9 years old and you're, you know, experiencing pain and you're alone and all the rest, you don't know whether you're going to die or not that night. And he was quite a remarkable individual and managed to brighten the lives of countless young patients over the years at St. Joseph's Health Center. But no, I don't ever feel burdened that way, because I think part of the difficulty within our culture is that we have 15% of our population who have some kind of definable disability. That's 1.8 million people. And it's, you know, half pretty much with physical disabilities and half with the so-called invisible disabilities that are nonetheless just as limiting a condition. And I think far too many of them are people that have simply never had a chance, have not been able to fulfill their potential and just get roadblocked and stymied at each step of the way. And it really is the one remaining minority group in our culture who really, as a collective whole, really don't have full civil rights yet.
Wow. Wow. Lieutenant Governor, you had this great time at the Paralympic Games in BC a few years ago. You had some wonderful time with Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh during their visit to Ontario. Is there anything about her that you would want the rest of us to know now that you've spent some time with her?
Yes, thank you. It's a great question, and I do. And that is that the person that you see on television or in documentaries or read about really is the person that you would meet if you had that opportunity. She is very warm, very engaging, very knowledgeable, and immediately seeks to put you at ease. She understands that you are caught up in the moment because it is a really unique opportunity to meet the Queen of England, but she tries immediately to put you at ease and speak person to person. And each of the conversations that we have had, whether it was the first formal meeting at Buckingham Palace or on about four separate occasions during the visit last summer, each and every time, that was the part that I took away as being so completely memorable. I've said to people, if you didn't know who this person was, and if in fact she wasn't the Queen of England, and you just met her in a social context, and about a month later, you were trying to have a nice party reception at your place, inevitably you would say, you know, we really should invite that nice lady we met a month ago.
What was her name? Liz. That's Where's her number? Let's give her a ring.
Yes. Good luck. So there is that tremendously positive human quality, and as I said to her, as I was in our second to last conversation during her visit, actually to the Lieutenant Governor's suite of offices at Queen's Park, it had been the earliest movement and processing of awareness about disability rights in North America, certainly in Canada, actually began with the Queen. Not long after she took off, after she ascended to the throne, because she was the one that began the process of having, in many instances, wounded veterans from World War II, but people in wheelchairs sitting at the front, deliberately positioned at the front for her different walkabouts and events. And when Prince Edward was in town, and there's this wonderful picture, by the way, as I was one of those kids in the 1959 visit, where the Queen was doing the walkabout, and it just happened.
Really?
The picture was snapped, and the next day it appeared in the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, the Telegram. It was really quite remarkable.
And you were in that shot.
And I was in that shot. The reason we know it's me is that it was 89 blistering, humid degrees, and all the kids were wearing short sleeve shirts and open neck. My grandfather, being British,
oh, no.
said that if his grandson was to be received by the Queen, I'd be wearing my wool blazer, I believe wool shirt, wool tie, and for all I can remember, wool underwear. I exaggerate, but only slightly.
Yeah.
And so there's one kid wearing a black blazer.
And there he is.
And there it is.
That's classic.
But when I asked Prince Edward about this a couple of years ago, as I showed him the picture, and he got quite a chuckle out of it, was he said that he asked his mother, as a young boy, why do we do this? Why do we have people in wheelchairs at the front row of our walkabouts? And the Queen said, because she wanted people to see that people with disabilities had equal rights too, that they should be treated as people.
Good for her.
It really, indeed. And that was, very early 1950s. So I had this opportunity to talk to her about what I was doing in terms of accessibility and to thank her privately, but for specifically for beginning that process of awareness. And she accepted the thanks with gratitude because she said she believed it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. True. Well, look, you have given us so much time, and I guess I really want to just finish this conversation by asking you how you navigate the God stuff with your job description. I remember having Mr. Harper on our show just prior to him becoming prime minister, and he spoke quite candidly about his faith, well, as candidly as he speaks about any personal matters. And I have admired him from a distance for a couple of reasons, not necessarily politically speaking, but the way he navigates and negotiates his faith in his job description. He doesn't let the Christian right, if they exist in this country, the gang of Jesus people, they don't control him.
Mm-hmm.
He is very strategic, and I just wonder how the faith fits in with your job.
Well, it's fundamental to my belief structure and how I try to live my life every day and how Ruth and I live as a couple. At the same time, the nature of the position is that I represent the Queen in the province and therefore am her representative to all of the people, whether they are Christians or Muslims or Jews or have no faith at all or are militant atheists. So I represent on the Queen's behalf, I represent myself, her position to everyone and the office of Lieutenant Governor. So my position is to try to live out my faith and belief in Christ as my personal Savior in the way I conduct my affairs and in the way that I interact with people, which is to be that reflection in what it is that we say and we do.
But, Your Honor, do you feel any pressure to maybe tuck your faith away sometimes?
Not really. No. I think it's just a matter of just being appropriate for the moment.
Yes. Yeah.
So, to return to the phraseology and the scripture that I used insofar as the Ryan Russell funeral was concerned, that wasn't a time to present a gospel message, not that that ever would be actually the position of the Lieutenant Governor,
no.
But it was appropriate to quote the Psalms. And that was just, in fact, what I did.
Well, 1984, Toronto Life magazine named you one of the Torontonians most likely to succeed, and by golly, you've done a good job at that.
Well, thank you very, very kindly, and thank you for your research. It's exquisite.
Will you please say good day to Ruth Ann for me? I met her quite briefly at a friend of mine named George Oliver had a concert, and she was out in the foyer chatting with people, and boy, what a you married up big time, didn't you?
Oh yes, definitely above my pay grade.
Quite
a
gal.
We all should be that lucky.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, the Honorable David C. Onley has been our guest, Lieutenant Governor of Ontario, and it's been an honor, actually. It has.
Thank you very much, Joe. Look forward to doing it somewhere down the line.
I hope so. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, we didn't think we'd go that long, but we had a guest go missing, and his honor was more than willing to stay with us. And what an interesting fellow. What an interesting fellow. All right, a short break on our show, and when we come back, Rabbi Jonathan Burness. He's the author of A Rabbi Looks at Jesus of Nazareth. Quite interesting information. Again, he talks about discovering Jesus in history and how it was that the Jewish Yeshua became the Gentile Jesus. And he presents some historic evidence that Jesus is Messiah and refutes common Jewish objectives. He gives Christians some knowledge and tools that they might need if they wanted to talk with their Jewish friends about Jesus. So there are some facts that I'm looking forward to hearing from this next guest, that's for sure. Diane Lee Clemens and Amoy Levy, gospel recording artists, will join us just shortly after that. And then Michael Sweet, the frontman for Striper, later in the show. Stay with us.
You're listening to the show that talks about stuff the others can't, don't, or won't. The Drew Marshall Show on Joy 1250.
Warm-ups underway. Wait till our lips are met. Wait till you see this.
Maybe you've been thinking about advertising your organization on the radio, but don't really have the budget for a long-term marketing campaign? Well, what if we gave you a show? The Drew Marshall Show is currently offering an innovative advertising concept for the small business owner or charity. With web stats and listenership at an all-time high, Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show is offering you an opportunity to partner with us, one show at a time. Consider sponsoring one show and we'll introduce you to our listening audience for the day. Drew will mention your organization every hour during our four-hour show, including a live phone interview. We'll also post your logo and website link on our website for an entire month. If you're thinking about promoting a special event, product, or upcoming sale, or if you just want to test the radio advertising waters without a huge investment, then consider becoming a one-day advertising partner with The Drew Marshall Show. Go to drewmarshall.ca for details or call Joy 1250 on 905-845-2821, extension 367. That's 905-845-2821, extension 367.